Hey, welcome to Athlete on Fire. You guys are listening to The Voyage into Hell. This is a series I'm doing with the author of the book of the same name, Steve Segwa. We are making our way across the world. We're literally halfway across the world at this point. Well, just about. And we're about to leave Australia. We've been hanging out in Darwin, Australia for a bit. We're heading up to Indonesia, and there's some crazy stories of customs, and we're going to get into that. Of course, Steve is calling today from St. Lucia, somewhere in the Caribbean. It doesn't really matter at this point. All he does is call and brags before we get on air, so I really have no comments on that. But if you guys are here for the first time, this is Chapter 9. We're not even halfway through the book. We're having a fun time. We're going on these adventures. I'm posting these mostly on the weekends, so you can kind of get away in your mind, whether you're on a long run or a bike ride or something, to experience some of these adventures that Steve and his wife Maria went through. And today is no different. You can learn more at athleteonfire.com if you found this podcast somewhere else. We have tons of podcasts with tons of adventurous athletes and entrepreneurs, and I think you guys will really enjoy that. So let's get into it. Steve, how are you doing today, sir?
Oh, good, Scott. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm great. I like to give you updates in Colorado since you're from here. You live here usually. Good weather. It's about 45 today. And I think it's a little cooler than where you're at, but I hope you're enjoying St. Lucia. How's it going down there?
Oh, we're doing well. It's about 86 degrees right now. We're sweltering on the boat because the sun's directly overhead. It happens every day, you know, so it's okay.
Do you like the heat?
We tolerate the heat. You know, once the sun tends to set, we get very active because you can only do things in the morning and the evenings when it's cool.
Hello?
Cooler. During the middle of the day, you can't. So, yeah, we kind of like the heat, but, you know, we've become accustomed to it. Let's say that.
Awesome. So, Hello? Are you guys in port right now? How are you getting internet? I'm just kind of curious.
Oh, well, I'm using my iPhone. I've got a SIM card in there that has data on it, so I have to connect through that. I use it as my personal hotspot, and I connect with the computer through Skype. So that works pretty good.
Oh, nice. And you guys, if you're listening, Steve he's sailing right now pretty much. So if we cut out every once in a while, I'll do my best to edit. But most of the time, it's only for about 4 or 5 seconds. So you guys can hopefully fill in the blanks. I'm filling in blanks every once in a while, and we'll work through it. So you guys are leaving. You guys are leaving Darwin. You guys are done with Darwin, and we're moving into the third and fourth world. Just from some foreshadowing in the last chapter, it seems like things are getting a little more intense, a little more adventurous, so to speak, a little more risky. So tell me about your mindset before you guys are heading off. And I guess you guys are headed for Kupang or Kupang, Indonesia?
That's correct, yes. Well, we're going to sail from Australia, a very modern country, and now we're going into the third world, as was referred to, and sometimes the fourth world, which it isn't even third world. Very basic provisioning there, foodstuffs, and the people, of course, are friendly sometimes. You've got a lot of pirate activity in Indonesia, so we have to now start watching out for pirate activity. This is going to become more and more intense as we go further north out of Australia. So we got to have the boat in great shape. And we don't want to break down because getting parts is very difficult in these third world countries. So you want to be self-sufficient as much as you can.
So what are some things that you did to ensure that you're self-sufficient? Like, you can't control some things breaking down, you know?
Yeah, you can't. But, we fixed everything we could in Australia. We got backup parts for everything except for a few crucial things. And that's what we had trouble with on the way to Indonesia, because when we went to pull out of Australia, our windlass decided to quit. Now, a windlass is a thing that pulls up the chain. And it's very essential on a boat because you've got 100 feet of this heavy chain sitting on the ocean floor, and you want to get it out of the water and pull your anchor up when you want to leave. Now, this is very important, and of course ours failed right as we wanted to leave Australia, so it's too late to order another one. Besides, they're way too expensive. You're talking about $1,200 for one, so we're just figuring, well, we'll get it repaired if we can in Indonesia. We'll see how that works. So that's something you would have liked the backup, but having a $1,200 backup piece is not something you normally have.
How heavy is the length of chain?
Oh, my God. Usually we have about 100 and 120 feet of chain out, and that thing, it weighs, you're talking about several hundred pounds. So when it won't come up with the windlass that pulls it up, you have to pull it up by hand. So you sweat a lot when you do that.
is that like a legit workout? Is it really hard to get it up there?
Oh, yes. Oh, very difficult workout. You put gloves on, and Maria usually operates the anchor for me. But no, I had to sit on the bow and pull the stuff in by hand, feed it down this little tube back into Aspen. And that took us probably, you know, five times as long as the electric windlass, which will pick it up in about 5 minutes. So it took me like 20 minutes to get it up.
Is it just a little rotor? Is it just a little engine that that spins it onto a spool or something? Or
it's an engine, but it's not little. The thing is, the windlass is very heavy. It weighs about 50 pounds, and it's powered by essentially a starter motor. So very heavy duty, very robust, but the starter motors burn out from time to time. That's what happened with us.
So you guys are – you know your windlass is out. You still need to head up to Indonesia. You got to get out of Darwin. What happened on the way up there? Did you guys make it?
Well, he did. What happens now, we're going again towards the equator. So as we got our anchor back up on board Aspen, it was like a 4-day trip to Indonesia. And you've got now, because you're nearing the equator again, you've got squalls, you've got lightning storms everywhere. We had very little wind, so we had to motor most of the way. We would motor sail. You'd have the sails up, but there wasn't, again, a lot of wind. So you're using fuel, but you just want to get to Indonesia. But the conditions were very rough. The seas were very tall, very high, and confused. But you know, you just make your way there. And again, 4 days later, we end up in Kupang, Indonesia, just north of Darwin, Australia.
Okay, so you guys are up there. You're making way to land. I'm assuming you're going to get the windlass fixed. What were some of the things you guys were doing on the island when you first got there?
Well, so when we arrived, the first thing you do, you have to go to shore and get permission to enter the country. And remember, we got our permit in Australia, and that took forever. We got the official Indonesian permit. We go to check into the country, and it's Sunday. Well, this is a Muslim country. Indonesia is all Muslim, so Sunday is nothing to them. Their weekend is Friday and Saturday. So, this is great. We're there on a Sunday. You have to get local money when you first arrive, and then you go to the customs and immigration, the port offices. So we got clearance from everybody except customs. Customs wasn't going to give us permission. They said, no, you have to come back. You have to come back. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. We need this stamp in order to stay here. What happened was the rally management who met us in Kupang didn't want to pay an exorbitant bribe to the customs officials. Everybody else was fine with the previous fees, but customs wanted more money this time. Instead of $600 to enter the country, they wanted $800. And the rally management goes, no, we're not going to do that. So customs says, okay, we're not going to give you permission to enter the country. Come back tomorrow. And so that drug out for quite a while, and that's what we're dealing with why we're sitting in Kupang.
Oh my gosh. So eventually I'm assuming they let you in, or what happened?
No, what happened then? Oh, this is cool. So I brought my windlass to shore. It's a complex story, but I bring my windlass to shore to get fixed. And I find a guy named Tiger, and he speaks great English. And he takes it away, and he keeps it for 2 days and then brings it back fixed. So this is cool. So I get it back after 2 days, and I install it on a boat, and then we get this call just as I'm installing it, sweating bullets. I mean, it's 100 degrees out there. I get this call on the radio, so we've got an emergency meeting on land. You have to be here immediately. So we zip in there right as I got the windlass done. We go to this meeting with rally management, and they say, oh, customs will not permit us to enter the country. So before daylight tomorrow, we have to be gone, or they will impound all of our boats.
Holy crap. Okay, before you left, there was one story I wanted to go. So one of your buddies, you guys created a motorcycle gang. Is that what I saw?
We did. You know, what happens, the people in Kupang, the locals, wanted to do this tour. They've never done a scooter tour. And they had all these scooters, and they said, would you guys like to do this? And, oh, yeah. Well, half the rally, there might have been 20 people, rented scooters. So we're zipping all over the countryside, and one of the drivers was Phyllis. You know, our friend Phyllis, she gets on this scooter. Well, she can't drive a motor scooter in Indonesia. Again, it's Muslim. She's a passenger. So she has this Indonesian guy following ups, and he's driving the scooter. Well, Phyllis is so effervescent. She convinces the guy to let her steer because she says she's ridden motorcycles since she was like 5 years old, so it's no big deal. So Phyllis is tooling around with our group, and we're just screaming down these roads in Indonesia, screaming at 30 miles an hour. You know, you can't go much faster. It's full of potholes, and the scooters don't go that fast. So we're going about 30 miles an hour, and Phyllis was at the back of the group, and she took a turn that had gravel in it and spun out. and just laid the bike down, collided with the side of a house, and got really scraped up. So our group, I was in the front with a bunch of British people. We hear this word passed up to us that Phyllis has had an accident. So we sit there in the middle of the road about a mile in front of Phyllis, and we have to have a meeting of whether we're going to go back and see Phyllis or not. I'm like, you know, guys, this is a no-brainer. I mean, Phyllis is part of our group. So we finally decide, yeah, it's a good thing to go back and see Phyllis. So we all motor back, and here's Phyllis inside of a local house, all cut up. Maria goes in because she's a nurse, and she said, no, her head's okay. She had a helmet on. But Phyllis got really scraped up, a lot of road rash, and so they took Phyllis to the hospital to get bandaged up, and it was quite an ordeal, but that was our cycle tour of Kupang.
Those things are not... You know, we traveled in Southeast Asia a lot, and those scooters, man, they were not all built equally. You could pay a couple bucks for one for a whole day, and it runs fine all day, and the next one won't start unless you're in second gear, popping a clutch, and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. So they definitely were not all created equally, and I'm sure I bet there's a lot of accidents in Southeast Asia and Indonesia, people trying to hop on scooters that have no experience.
they've got to be. You know, you're right. And now Phyllis is, unfortunately, she bent the bike up pretty badly, so they hauled it away on a truck too.
So you had this. Just to go back to the emergency meeting, I'm sure Phyllis is making a recovery, and they're basically saying, okay, you got to get out of this country. How long were you guys there? A day or two?
No, we were there 3 days was all, and we had a party just before the third day, a tourism party where all the immigration officials were there. This is a high level meeting. The tourism officials there and customs did not come to the meeting, this welcome to us. They snubbed us. They said, no, we're not going because we're not going to let you into the country. And rally management got up in front of this meeting and was really nasty to the customs officials, knowing that word would get back to them how upset they were. Well, that didn't go over well. So this was the party, and Phyllis showed up at the party all bandaged up, and she's leading the dancers around the room. It was a great time, except for a little attitude by the customs people who weren't there. But we had a great time. But then we got the word that we had to leave again the next morning. So we weren't into Kupang as long as we wanted.
It's kind of crazy because they're going to – I mean, the little town's going to make so much more money off of travelers if you stay. You know, it's just a couple $100 here and there is kind of goofy.
Exactly, and that's why the local people were not happy with customs. But customs wanted to line their own pockets, and this is how it works. Some third world countries.
That's so weird. All right, so the T-shirts and the collision. There's a little sub chapter on that. Do you have any good takeaways there?
So the evening before we had to get out of the port the next morning, that evening everybody on the rally had ordered all these T-shirts, these local T-shirts. We're trying to help the economy, and we didn't have our T-shirts. So I make a call to the guy who's printing them, and he says, oh, he'll have them there. So they show up late that night. I see these headlights on the dock. We're all anchored out in the bay. You see headlights, and I know that it's the guy with the T-shirt. So I go zipping in, and he's got all these packages laid out on the dock. I mean, it could have been a drug run for all anybody knew. And I just rip in there with another guy, pick up all these packages, put them in our little dinghy, and then distribute them to the rally people at nearly midnight. So it's an incredible scene out there. And the guy gets his money, we get our T-shirts, and now we're just going to get out of town just like in the Wild West before the sun rises.
What did the T-shirt say?
Oh, the teachers, they had the rally name. It had all the boats' names on there. And it was really, and it said, you know, Kupang, Indonesia. Just a really neat T-shirt.
Who designed it?
The local people designed it.
Oh,
So we've got very nice working with them.
Oh, nice. Okay, so you guys got to get out of there. You're leaving it pretty early that day. You're headed towards, was it Rinca Island? Is that your next stop?
Right. We've got Rinca, what happened, we decided to stop at Rinca. Actually, we're heading towards Bali. Bali is another port where we can legally enter Indonesia. So we're going to sail from Kupang over to Bali illegally. We're illegal immigrants into the country, and this doesn't sit well if they catch us. So we decided to make a stop on the way, which is Rinca Island. And it's famous because it contains Komodo dragons, the famous Komodo dragons. That's why we wanted to stop there. So on the way there, we're with a group of boats that travel about the same speed. We're all sailing. It's kind of pretty cool. Not high winds at all, very nice conditions. And one sailboat, there was a woman on watch. It's during the day. I mean, it's the middle of the day, bright sunlight. She's in the cockpit knitting. Well, this is fine, except that she forgot to look at where she was on the ocean, and there's little islands everywhere that were sailing by. Well, their boat was headed towards an island, and we didn't think anything about it. They figured they just wanted to take a look at this island. Well, essentially, their boat hit the island straight on, just hit it. And like, oh my God, their mast, you know, squashes over to the side, and the boat careens. What's going on here? And the husband sticks his head up, and he sees what's happening. He grabs a wheel, and they go away from the island, and he radios everybody. He says, "Ah, oh, it's okay, it's okay. We're not taking on water, but we've got this turn in our boat now, so something's not right. The boat tended to turn to the left a lot, so we bent something underwater," and she didn't knit again on that trip, I don't think.
You know, that's why I never took up knitting right there. That's the exact reason. Actually, this is crazy. So we have this correspondent for Athlete on Fire. She does these small little snippets for another show that we do, and she did a story on this woman who ran the Boston Marathon while she was knitting the whole time.
Oh, my God.
It's like unbelievable. Like, I can barely run in a straight line, and that's just crazy. So you get to Rink Island kind of just to check out the Komodo dragons. Tell me about Komodo dragons. Why did you guys want to see them? Is this where they originated? You know, just a little bit about them.
Yes, this is where they're from. Actually, there's an island just adjacent to Rinka. Rinka is an island that's uninhabited except for the fishermen who go there, and sometimes they hunt the dragons, but usually the dragons hunt the fishermen, so they got to be very careful. But then the adjacent island is a park where they have Komodo dragons. All the tourists go there, but we can't go there again because we're illegal in Indonesia. So we've got to go to the other island where the Komodo dragons are wild. Komodo dragons are about the size of two, three men. I mean, they're massive things. They grow to that size, and then they hunt while they're on the islands. They usually hunt boars, wild boars, pigs, and they grab these things and they just strip them. And so what I did, we went to the beach and we searched for these Komodo dragons. Well, they're nowhere in sight because they usually are not out in the direct sunlight, which is a good thing. So we went through the bush and saw these massive holes there, but no dragons. Oh, this is cool. So the next morning, I decided to take a run, of course, and I'm running through the bush and all over the place. And on the beach, there's this wild boar carcass, just the ribs, and it's got fresh meat that's kind of stripped off of it, but there's some still hanging there. I'm going, oh, that's very odd. This wasn't there yesterday. And I take the carcass and drag it into the bush for some reason. I didn't want it to mess up the beach. And so I go running and all this, and I come back after about an hour, hour and a half, and I go back to the boat, and then our neighboring boat says, "Oh, Steve, did you see that dragon when you were on shore?" I said, "Pardon? What dragon?" "Well, if you looked at the beach now, there's a Komodo dragon dragging the carcass out of the bush, and this dragon's huge. I mean, they will attack you. I mean, you don't want to be near a Komodo dragon." I'm like, "Oh my God, that's what they look like. Oh, I'm sorry I didn't see that."
Oh, so how, man. What's their – do they have strong claws, strong jaws? Like, what's their – I know what they look like.
Yeah, they have the strong claws, and if they bite you, what happens? They have a bacteria in their mouth, and it will infect you, and you will most likely die because you can't get medical attention soon enough.
Oh, man. So what are there tons of them on this island?
Well, we don't know how many. We didn't count them. But you know, what happens, the fishermen will come by and they'll warn you. If the dragons are feeding, they'll say, "Okay, don't go on the beach because there's too many dragons now." But, I mean, you're talking about, you know, maybe, I don't know, 50, 100 dragons on this island. It's a rather large island. So, yeah, you just don't want to run into them.
They're so creepy looking. They're dinosaurs.
They are. They are. They are.
Hey, Steve, are you there?
You know, very scary looking, and they plot on to be there.
Oh, there you go.
I'm still here.
Okay, yeah, I lost you.
You there, Scott?
Okay. Yes, sir. Yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm on National Geographic. Every time we bring up animals, I'm like, oh, I'm going to look at them while I'm talking about them. Pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, so you did not get eaten by a Komodo dragon. That is on the record now. And
that's on record, yeah.
I'm glad. That's great. So you guys need to head out to Bali. How far did you have to sail? What was it like landing and experiencing the country or island of Bali?
Bali. We're just looking forward to Bali. It's from where we were with the Komodo dragons. It's probably still a 2-day sail there. We stopped at one other island, Giliere, along the way. It's a magical place. Just a day stop for tourists from Bali. They just come over on a motorboat from Bali itself and visit there. But we visited the same island, Giliere, and then went to Bali. Bali's where they made the movie 1958 South Pacific with Mitzi Gaynor. It's the ideal South Pacific island, except that it's in Indonesia. But this is a really cool island, we thought. And we arrive at the marina. And the marina is a hole. It's filthy. It's totally filthy. The docks are lucky they're staying together. And we have to tie up here. They flush all the sewers from the town into the marina every night. And you first get this stench and you go, oh no, not again tonight. Oh, it's a horrible, horrible place. But we had to go there because, again, we were illegal. And I told all our friends back home, don't send lawyers, guns, or money yet. But if this fails, you might have to send those to get us into Indonesia in Bali. So so that's what we did. We met with the officials in it's crazy.
Why do I imagine Bali is just this paradise? Like, you see pictures, it looks really pretty, but why is it just overpopulated now? What's the deal?
No, what happens is, the tourists go there, and they go to places like Sanur and Kuta. You've got great resorts there. You got great beaches, but they're all, fenced in, and you stay there, and it's great. And then you go to the town, and the town is, it's highly overpopulated, but it's a Hindu island. It's all Hindu. This is not Muslim anymore. It's like a little paradise unto itself, Hindu, but it's very basic, very poor, except at the great resorts. As long as you don't leave the resorts too much, you're okay, but you can go visiting. So what happened, we got into the marina again, and we're able to convince the customs people to clear us in. They paid a little bribe, got us into the country. Great, now we're safe. Now we'll go visit what's in Bali. And that's where you can visit different places that are very safe and very historic. We visited the place, which is Ubud, the cultural center of Bali. It's in the mountains. Bali contains these mountains. You get a driver to drive you there. There's a reason to get a driver. We had a couple with us, a Spanish couple, who tried to rent a car. Okay, and they rented a car. They're going to drive from the marina up to Ubud, same place we were going, but we had a driver. So they get in their car, and they exit the marina area and go to the first roundabout and get pulled over by an Indonesian policeman. And say, and the Spanish guy goes, so what did I do? Why did I do wrong? And the Indonesia policeman says, big fine here, big fine. What did I do wrong? And the policeman says, you weren't wearing a helmet.
Oh, jeez.
And the guy says, wait a minute, I'm in a car. We don't have to have a helmet in the car. And the policeman says, yes, you do. You have to have a helmet. And all these cars are driving by, of course. Nobody's got a helmet on. This was just the ruse to get money out of any tourist that wants to drive a car. So the Spanish people ended up paying $100 to the policeman on the spot to get out of this situation. And they immediately got in their car again after paying the $100, drove the car back to the marina, and got a driver for the rental car. Just a crazy place.
That's you get ripped off in other countries a lot of times just because it's just part of the deal.
You do,
but that's pretty bad. Yeah. That's a pretty bad one.
A bad.
So we're going through Bali. One question I was going to ask that's not directly in the story, but as far as vaccinations, you guys are getting into malaria world here shortly. What were you guys vaccinated for on this trip?
We got vaccinated for yellow fever, cholera, hepatitis, a lot of shots when we were in Colorado. We went to the travel people, and they just shake their head and say, oh, boy, here's the list, and I hate needles. Just hate them. So after the first shot, I was laying down as they gave me the rest of the series of shots, again, everything. But we had malaria pills that we had to take. So we began the malaria pills after Australia. The malaria pills are really good. They do protect you, but they give you vivid dreams. I mean, vivid dreams. It's the coolest thing you ever had. So this is great stuff.
Did you ever get – we had malaria pills last time we went to Southeast Asia. Did you guys ever get any bad nausea from the malaria pills?
We did not. No, we got lucky, I guess. So, no, we didn't have that.
Yeah, we did a couple times. Anyway, all right, so let's see here. You guys are in Bali. Something happens with Bob. The subtitle is Bob's Rally Problems. What happened with Bob this time? Because Bob is in every chapter.
He is. Poor Bob. Okay. So we're sitting, then we go, we come back to the marina from our trip to Ubud. While we're in Ubud, we saw the old king's funeral. The king died, so they had to have a funeral. Well, they had 6,000 pallbearers there, and they had a live goat's head for a while. It was live, and cow's head, they cut it off and sacrifice that. But we get done with the funeral pyre, and we get back to the marina, and here's Bob sitting at the head of the marina in the restaurant. So, Bob, what's going on? Bob's down in the dumps. He says, I lost my position on the boat I was on. Oh, so Maria, of course, she's the one who finds out stuff. She goes to the people whose boat she was on, and the wife had just flown in. Said, what's wrong with Bob? Bob's a great guy. And they said, well, what happened with Bob is they were searching the boat for something, and they found all these what they called bits and pieces all over the boat. Now this is a British couple, so they use different terms than we do, but yeah, bits and pieces. So, if you're caught with illegal substances anywhere in these countries, they will take your boat from you. So this is a serious problem if it happens. So they thought that this was attributed to Bob. So they said, Bob, you have to go immediately. So Bob's sitting up there now, and he doesn't know what to do. He gets kicked off the boat. He doesn't have another boat to go to. So this is close to evening. And Bob says, I'm flying over to Jakarta, and then I'm going to get a flight out of Indonesia. And so Bob disappears, and then I go back to the boat, and I get a call from Phyllis on my cell phone. And it's Phyllis, who's in the north side of the island. And Phyllis says, where's Bob? I said, well, Bob got kicked off the boat. He's going to head to Jakarta. And Phyllis goes, oh, no, because I found a boat that he can go on. I have to get in touch with Bob. So we had the whole rally searching for Bob that evening, and we found him before he got on the plane. And so Bob then gets another position on a massive catamaran in the rally in Indonesia, and they're going to take Bob all the way to Thailand. So now Bob's back on the rally. It's cool.
So he's on a catamaran with okay, gotcha. There's a little paragraph at the end of that sub, and it says, after finding his new position, Bob sailed all the way from Bali to Thailand with this new rally catamaran before meeting Scott Adam, owner of the Sailboat Quest. Was that just did you put that in there just to kind of let people know that because part of the title of your book is the Quest tragedy, was that just some foreshadowing?
It's foreshadowing, yes. Yeah, Bob, again, he had problems along the way, but he didn't know this boat that he's going to join in Thailand called Quest. So this is foreshadowing. Now he's got a great catamaran to be on, but it's only going to last till Thailand. So that is kind of helping the reader see what Bob's going to be up against coming up.
Okay, cool. All right, so we are having a little bit of connectivity issues. We only have a little bit more of this chapter, so let's try to push through it here. You guys are about to leave Bali, and you're going to cross the equator again. And the last time you guys crossed the equator, you guys did a toast to the gods, I believe, and you had to drink some rum or something. What were you doing this time when you crossed the equator?
This time, we were just trying to hang on to the boat for all we were worth because we had massive storms. Lightning was striking all around us. We had, it's just something to get across the equator this time. We did pour a little rum in there just to help Neptune. But again, we were hanging on for all we were worth trying to find shelter. It was a sail to Borneo. We had to sail up to Borneo to get fuel. It's a mess in there. You've got unlit fishing boats. They don't use lights on their boats at night. You're trying to avoid these things, not to crash into them. So it was really a struggle to get to the end of Indonesia, and that's what we were up against, which we did make it there, to Nansa Point Marina.
Nansa Point Marina. Are there a lot of is there a lot of lightning damage on boats?
Unfortunately, there are. What happens, they'll usually strike not at sea. I don't know why. You're the highest thing for miles around. They usually don't hit you at sea, but in the marinas, they do. So it's over land where they tend to be more intense. They hit at a boat, on the boat, or near the boat, and they'll blow out all your electronics. And so you don't have any electronics left. Hopefully it doesn't blow a hole through the bottom of your boat. But so then you have to replace all your electronics. But that's what was happening in Indonesia.
Wow. So before Nansa Point, though, there's a couple points that are interesting. You're talking about the amount of active volcanoes in Indonesia. Talk about that a little bit. I read there's 129 active volcanoes.
There's 129 active volcanoes in Indonesia. One of the most famous was Krakatoa. Krakatoa, the massive explosion that happened in 1883, nearly was the end of the planet. as we know it. I mean, this thing was, it was a massive explosion. There were tsunamis everywhere. It changed the world's weather. There was no summer that year. None. The clouds, I mean, it just put dust into the air that obscured everything. As far as England and North America, Krakatoa was a massive eruption. That was in Indonesia, and it affects the world. Well, Krakatoa blew itself apart, so it doesn't exist any longer. But now we've got another one called Anak Krakatoa. Yeah, it's the little brother of Krakatoa, and it's forming now. So, you know, in 10,000 years, it may blow itself up again, and that could be the demise of the world as we know it. So that's, it's so active in that in Indonesia with volcanoes and everything like that. Just horrible, horrible place for that.
Man, that one killed like 36,000 people from tsunamis and other side effects.
Exactly, from tsunamis mostly. It blew itself apart. I mean, an island just erupted and just blew itself to pieces. Incredible.
Wow. Okay, so you're Nangsa Point. Talk about that, arriving there. What was the feel? What were your goals while you were there?
Nangsa Point, it's really neat. What it is, it's the last point in Indonesia. So we're going to get out of Indonesia, and Singapore is 20 miles away. Singapore is a very modern city. We can get repairs done again because we've been in Indonesia for, 3-4 weeks now, and we're going to need things fixed on our boat again. So we're just sitting in this little marina, very nice, having a great time there, and we go to check out. But before we checked out, Phyllis gets kicked off the catamaran she was on. Phyllis is just the best person, as I've said before, nicest person. But if you're sailing on a boat for so long, tensions always arise. And this is what happened. She was sailing with another couple, and they decided it was time for Phyllis to go. So Phyllis leaves this nice catamaran, but gets picked up immediately on another monohull boat, a single-hull boat, and she's going to sail with them all the way to Thailand. So she also now has a ride all the way to Thailand. So this is cool. Bob's back on a rally. Phyllis is still on a rally. Now we just have to check out of Indonesia, get our permission to leave, and we go to the customs people, and again, it's Indonesia customs, so what do they say to us? Oh, no, you can't leave because you owe $100 more because you didn't pay enough when you were in Bali. Oh, man. So here's another shakedown before we can even leave the country.
How are you guys paying? Cash?
Cash. All cash.
So how much cash did you have to bring for bribes?
Well, you know, we relied on the rally management to bribe the officials, but usually the rally management would disappear when we decided to check in or check out, and we were left on our own a lot of times, especially with this checking out. They just kind of dismissed themselves. I had a meeting with the Indonesian officials. I represented the rally, and our rally management guy was with me, and he just kind of stood in the background and let me do everything. I'm like, no, this isn't how it's supposed to be. And he just, you know, shook his head. Yeah, $100. Oh, well, each boat has to pay $100. So you had to have cash stashed somewhere on the boat. But it usually was in local currency. So you're at a loss if you didn't have that. You'd have to go to the bank and try to get money out.
Was it kind of nerve-wracking to have, you know, I've traveled in countries that were poor, and you just have to have, you have to pay attention, you know, and for you on a boat, you're kind of stuck. I mean, were you guys nervous about having money on the boat like that?
Oh, very much so. You know, customs people come on all the time. They inspect things. So you really had things hidden very well, especially your money. It was hopefully in safe places. They usually, the customs people demanded wine, beer, rum, whiskey if you had it. They always wanted something if they came on your boat. So that was always a problem. And they would never outwardly ask for money. So that was a good thing. But you made sure your money was hidden.
Wow. One thing that you mentioned was the third, and you threw in the fourth world. What if you're going to make if you're going to define the difference between third and fourth world? What would be the distinguishing factors?
Okay, a third world. Indonesia has so many fishermen. They go out and they're very basic fishermen. Okay, they're catching fish. They're selling it to the first world countries, the United States a lot, England, but they're very poor people. Okay, fine, that's third world. Then you get even more basic than that. You get people in boats, they don't even have a light on the boat. And so if they're, some of the fishermen are very nice, nicest people in the world. When we buy shrimp in the States, we're happy that it's from Indonesia. This is great. But the fishermen are so poor, again, they can't afford a light for their boat. And if they see that you're on a collision course with them in the middle of the night, they'll light a fire on their boat, a campfire on the bow of their boat so you can see them. That fire is going to burn their boat down, man, if you're not careful. So, you know, they haven't been to school a lot of times. They know fishing. That's their life. So that's why I call them, you know, fourth world is really basic.
Wow. Wow. So any big takeaways before – I know we're heading to Singapore next. From this first taste of Indonesia, is there anything big, any big takeaways that we've missed before we move on?
Well, again, Indonesia is Indonesia. We went up what's called the Kumai River in Borneo, 25 miles up a filthy, dirty river to get fuel. But at the end of that trip, you can go visit the orangutans that are in the jungle. And that's in Borneo. So you can take fascinating trips like this. Well into the jungle, you go with local guides, and you're amongst the orangutans up there. You could do things like that, which is really neat in Indonesia. But we were very happy to leave Indonesia, kind of, because now, again, Singapore is 20 miles away. It's across the Malacca Straits, which is the worst pirate-infested area in the world.
Wow.
Until Somalia blew up. Now, we've got to cross that 20 miles through the pirate-infested straits, but Singapore is a great oasis we're going to visit with incredibly poor countries surrounding it, and then we're going to go to Malaysia, another one of the poorest countries in the world with massive fishing fleets that don't have lights, so that's where we're headed now.
Wow. So what were – well, we'll get into this next week too, but just really quickly, did you guys carry firearms?
No. This is a big controversy among sailors. Should you have a weapon or not? If you have a weapon, fine. I don't object to it. But you have to be able to kill a person with that weapon. That's the reason you have a weapon. If somebody comes on your boat, you kill them, period. You don't fire a warning shot. You're just going to kill them. Now, if you feel comfortable doing that, great. I don't have a problem if you want to do that. But for us in the rally, we were told we should not have firearms, and we did not. So that's where we were.
So is your take, you know, if you have good intentions, then hopefully good things happen. Is that kind of your take on things?
It is. And, you know, we have a flare gun. I don't know if you saw the movie Captain Ron. A flare gun, you know, burns a hole in your boat. It usually doesn't hurt anybody. So we could fire a warning shot with a flare gun. But, you know, as Americans, everybody thinks Americans are all armed anyway. We don't even have to have a weapon. We're an American. Oh, you've got weapons on board. Cool. Think that, even though we don't.
It's pretty funny.
So that was our take on it.
It's kind of funny, the idea that everybody has firearms in the States. It's kind of goofy. Although a lot of people that I know shouldn't have them, but that's besides the point. All right, man. So this is going to be fun. We're going to go to Singapore, a place that I spent a few hours at the Singapore airport, but no more than that. All I know is it was my introduction to toilets in the ground, and that's pretty cool. And so next week, we'll definitely dive into that. Thanks this week, Steve. Awesome storytelling as usual.
Well, thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
If you guys are listening, you can go check out more, athleteonfire.com. The story is Voyage into Hell, and we're just going to keep visiting until we get around the world with this amazing story. Thanks a lot, and until next time, take care.
Thank you for listening to Athlete on Fire. Stay fired up with additional resources and information at athleteonfire.com.